If you're at all like me and don't especially like eating a bunch of chemicals, then ButcherBox is just what you're looking for. When you get a ButcherBox membership, you'll have the peace of mind that you're getting high-quality meat, seafood, and poultry that you can trust. With 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork that's raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood, ButcherBox wants you to eat healthier than you ever have before. More importantly, there's no antibiotics or hormones in their meat, which might not always be the case at one of those big box stores. Another huge bonus with ButcherBox? They conveniently deliver directly to your doorstep. Save yourself the hassle of driving to the supermarket, or even putting on pants for that matter. And ButcherBox's prices are competitive, or even lower than what you'll find at your grocery store. ButcherBox also has a slew of delicious recipes and other cooking tips to help add a little pizzazz to your meals. At our house, we've tried a bunch of different meals, and they've been a huge hit every time. They're really good. And right now, just for our listeners, ButcherBox is offering ground beef for life with a new membership, plus an additional 20% off your first order. Use the link butcherbox.com/lisk and use the code LISK to get free ground beef for life, plus 20% off your first box. Again, that's butcherbox.com/LISK, L-I-S-K, and use code LISK.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mopac Audio.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of LISK. After reading and hearing about the role DNA played in the arrest of Rex Huerman, we wanted to try to better understand what exactly DNA is, how it's used, and how it helped bring Rex into custody. So we spoke with Cynthia Cal. She's a DNA expert and the founder of DNA Mavens, a nonprofit that works to lend their forensic expertise to those in need. She shares more layman's terms about DNA's use in crimes like the Gilgo 4 murders. Not shockingly, it's much more complex and a bit less dramatic than your average episode of Law & Order. There's a lot to consider when using DNA in a criminal case, like how was it collected? What conditions was the DNA being exposed to prior to being collected? How old it is? And in the case of Rex, is law enforcement relying on mitochondrial DNA or nuclear DNA? Because there is, in fact, a difference. But rather than try to explain it all now, I'll let Cindy Cale do that. It's a slightly more scientific episode than normal, but it really is a fascinating discussion. What does being a DNA expert entail?
Well, it's not only getting trained in all of the techniques that we use in the laboratory, it's also understanding the underlying theories, why those techniques work, how they work, how to apply them, and how to how they apply to a criminal investigation. And be able to go in and express my conclusions as to the results I obtained from that analysis and my opinions as well.
And this one's going to sound pretty basic, but could you just tell us what DNA is and break that down?
Right. So in terms of like forensic DNA analysis, there are actually two types of DNA that we can look at. We can look at nuclear DNA, which is found in the nucleus of a cell. And the way that's inherited is you inherit half of your DNA from your mom, half from your dad. The way it looks, like structurally, it looks like a spiral staircase. And so it has, you know, the backbone and then the internal structure makes up a kind of an alphabet. And those alphabets kind of make all the different functions go on in our bodies and how they're put together. But for forensics, we actually look at a specific segment of the DNA where it's not necessarily the sequence that is important, but it's the number of times that sequence repeats that differs from person to person. So that we are actually looking at not necessarily a difference in the sequence of DNA, but actually the length of a fragment of DNA. So that's what we focus on in forensics. We also can focus on what's called mitochondrial DNA, which is found in another organelle called the mitochondria, which is referred to as the powerhouse of the cell. It creates the energy for the cell, but it has its own form of DNA, which is actually inherited from mother to child. So it's only inherited from mother to child, and then only the female children can pass it on to their children.
You know, knowing with the Rex thing, so they had his and they had hers. Do you know if how that played a role, the mitochondrial DNA, the maternal line in this case, potentially?
I mean, they would have been able to maybe link her to her family line and him to his family line. But like together, they wouldn't have hit to each other in any way because they're not related in that way. So it would have been like a separate genetic match.
Yeah, but I guess where it does help is it's like we have this female DNA sample, mm-hmm. and we don't know who it is, and we didn't think there was a female involved, but lo and behold, she's married to the male sample.
Right.
So that creates...
Yeah, I mean, that really would help, you know, that information from both sides would really help them, you know, narrow down who it was.
Exactly. Like if they had his line, it could be 20 males.
Right.
But with her, they're like, okay, there's pretty much a few specifics we need to look at.
Right. Yeah.
Him.
Yeah.
Maybe the uncle who was over once in a while.
Right.
Or something.
But, yeah.
And you mentioned the one that you use in forensics. Why is it that specific one? Because it doesn't just give the blueprint, it gives the specifics, or how do you explain that?
Yeah, so typically the portions of the DNA we look at don't typically code for anything, so you can't really glean any like medical history from those segments of the DNA. They're more there to help with like the functioning of the genes, because there's certain spacing that has to happen for genes to function properly, and those kind of help with those functions. But really what we are looking at really don't code for anything. So they're nice because they don't, you can't get any kind of medical history from them, but they're also nice because there's so many of them. They're so abundant in the genome. There's such a variety of them. So it gives us the ability to be able to tell the difference between two people, especially if we look at multiple locations, we're able to say this person's excluded and this person's included. But we're also able to look at multiple locations in one reaction because they're so small, and we can actually, not only are they separated by the length of the DNA fragments, but we also incorporate colors so that we can tell the difference between, you know, similarly sized DNA fragments at different locations.
That's really good. Yeah, it helps just to understand how it all works, you know, beyond the top surface. And again, this is another basic question, but, you know, it's like, is DNA alive? Because, you know, it can break down. So how does that work?
Well, DNA contains all the instructions for all the chemical processes that occur within our body and all our physical features. So in a sense, yes, it is alive. It helps create new cells. It directs all the different creations of different proteins in our body. So it has a huge impact on everything that's contained within our body. But once it's outside of the nucleus, it can be broken down and degraded and non-functional.
And then, and I'm sure you get this question a lot, but, you know, how is the real forensics, you know, work of DNA different from what we see on TV?
Well, obviously, I don't wear leather and stiletto heels to work. I don't work in the dark. And, you know, because all those shows, I always see them like working with a flashlight, and it's not well lit. We work in a lab. Typically, we're working batches of cases. We're not just working on one case. So we're not concentrating just on one case at a time in a half an hour period. Or an hour period, and not necessarily solving a case in an hour. It may not even solve a case with the DNA, because it may come back that the DNA results are just not helpful at all. But usually, like the DNA analysis process, the steps in the lab don't take very long, maybe 3 or 4 days, but then the data interpretation can take longer. And then forensic labs are held to a standard where they have to have somebody, you know, once the analyst has, you know, reviewed the data, interpreted the data, and created a report, somebody else has to go back behind and do a technical review. So to make sure that those results are accurate and that we're reporting accurate conclusions. And so it goes through several of those kind of rounds of technical review and administrative review before it's even issued. And then, so maybe 2 weeks for a case, but with all the cases and the backlogs, you may submit a case one day and you might not get results for 6 months. So it just really depends on.
Well, those shows have been lying to us because It takes like, by the time they get back to the lab, they're like, yeah, we have it. It's this guy.
Yeah.
You know,
there
it
is
doesn't
a new,
happen that way.
Yeah. There is a new instrument out there that can generate a DNA profile within 90 minutes. So you put the swab in a cartridge, you put it in the machine, and the machine is self-contained. So it does all the DNA analysis parts within the machine and then spits out the DNA profile in about an hour and a half.
That sounds like an amazing machine. It reminded me of Elizabeth Holmes, you know, like it's all self-contained but it sounds like this is the real deal in a sense of for DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And another thing about TV is they always portray DNA as like open and shut case. Like it's easy. We've got the DNA. How is that different? And, you know, like, is there a case that you've worked on, of course, no names, but that shows kind of the pitfalls of DNA, especially if you're not taking the right steps?
Yeah. So our DNA results only can speak to who is present in a sample, not necessarily how or when that DNA came to be on the object. So the research I've done focuses on that DNA transfer. So DNA transfer can be either direct transfer or indirect transfer. So direct transfer is where I'm actually holding an object and my DNA is being transferred directly onto that surface. It also could be, you know, if I'm talking or sneezing or coughing, you know, I could be getting spit on the surface. There's nothing in between me and that surface. Now with indirect transfer, there's something that's helping along my DNA to get onto a surface. So for example, if you shake hands with me, my DNA could get on your hand, your DNA could get on my hand. Now, if you go touch an object, you could transfer your DNA to that object, but you could also transfer my DNA to that object. So my DNA could be picked up and detected on that object without me ever touching it. So can be problematic when you're looking at DNA results, because we get asked a lot, you know, how did somebody's DNA get on there? When did it? And we really can't speak to that. I can go back to the literature and kind of see what we've seen, you know, just under experimental conditions. But in casework, we really don't have that answer. We don't know. The one case that I know of has shown up in forensic files. It was just a recent forensic files episode, but I'm familiar with it. But the gentleman's name was Lucas Anderson. I mean, this is all out in the public right now. But he was arrested for the murder of an individual because his DNA was found under the decedent's fingernails. And Lucas was just like, it can't be me. I was in the hospital at that time. Here are all, you know, all the records. And he sat in jail for several months before they started looking at these records and realized that the paramedics that had worked on him also had worked on the decedent and somehow transferred his DNA, Lucas's DNA, to the decedent at the scene without Lucas ever being there. And that's the one case that I know of where we had concrete evidence that indirect transfer happened. So it just speaks to, you know, you just need to be careful about what you say when you go in to testify. You know, there are limitations to our testing and not to overstate the weight of that evidence in terms of saying, this DNA can only be direct, you know, transfer, or it can't be indirect transfer. So we have to be very careful about how we present that evidence.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's almost like it detects too much where you're like, when you have, you know, like if on our second floor office, you could have 700 DNA profiles, but, you know, that's over the years.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, even in the 20 years I've been in the field, when I first started, we didn't have to deal like with a lot of mixed DNA profiles because the sensitivity wasn't there. Now, I think the majority of the DNA profiles that we have to interpret are mixed DNA profiles of anywhere from 2 to 5 individuals and even more. And I mean, there's a point where we're like, this is just too complex. We can't do anything with it. Because as more individuals contribute to a DNA profile, it's harder and harder to exclude somebody because there's just so much overlap and you could have all these different genetic combinations happening. You can't really make sense of it.
You may have heard that Shopify has been helping millions of people sell their products online. But did you know that Shopify is helping stores around the world sell in person too? Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. It's easier than ever to do everything from accepting payments to managing inventory. So when customers search for that thing they want, it's there. Shopify has everything you need to sell to your customers in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse partner that can track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. It's easier than ever to connect with customers online and in line, too. Shopify helps drive sales with their intuitive plug-and-play tools to get the word out on TikTok, Instagram, and pretty much any other social platform. Shopify has the hardware that'll fit your business. Take payments by phone, turn your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device to alleviate all those sales headaches. And if you ever run into problems, Shopify's award-winning support team is there to smooth things out. Do retail right with Shopify. So sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/lisk. That's L-I-S-K, all lowercase. Again, go to shopify.com/lisk to take your retail business to the next level today. One last time, go to shopify.com/lisk. The highly anticipated second season of the hit podcast Proof is finally here. Proof is an investigative true crime podcast co-hosted by Susan Simpson of Undisclosed and Jacinda Davis of Evil Lives Here. Proof made headlines for its first season in 2022 after proving the innocence of two Georgia men serving life sentences for murdering their friend Brian Bowling when they were just 17 years old. 25 years later, on December 8th, 2022, both men were finally freed based on evidence unearthed by Proof. In the second season of Proof, Murder at the Warehouse, Susan and Jacinda are on the case again, this time traveling the streets of Manteca, California, to uncover who really murdered 18-year-old Renee Ramos. On June 5th, 2000, Ramos's body was found buried under a pile of debris inside the shell of a new Home Depot building. Despite tips hinting at alternate suspects, tips that were ignored until now, Renee's boyfriend, 18-year-old skater Jake Silva, and Ty Lopez, the 33-year-old uncle of one of Jake's close friends, were arrested and convicted of her murder. Fans of true crime and investigative series won't want to miss this riveting new season. Follow the case as Susan and Jacinda uncover long-overlooked evidence about what really happened to Renee by listening to Proof, Murder at the Warehouse, wherever you get your podcasts. You know, as far as your witness testimony in DNA cases, you know, because I think probably jurors, again, I consider myself kind of that middle of the road guy who knows enough, but not enough. Jurors, you know, how do they treat DNA and what's the biggest stumbling block they have when they see it in cases, would you say?
Well, I think, like you said, I think sometimes it's seen as the gold standard. And if you have DNA evidence and the defendant can't be excluded as a contributor, I think that's tends to be weighted heavily over everything else, especially if we give a statistic. So whenever we do a comparison and we say somebody can't be excluded, we have to offer kind of a statistical weight to that. And now our statistical weights are astronomical. I mean, they're like nanillions and octillions and stuff like that, high numbers like that. And when they hear that number, it's like open and close, you know, the doors open and close. It's a done deal. But like I said before, you can't take it in isolation. You have to consider all the circumstantial evidence that's associated with that case, particularly if the only thing linking that individual to the case is the DNA. There has to be other things that go along with that that kind of solidify that person was involved in that criminal activity.
Yeah, it would make sense, like, you know, if it's a rape case and there's semen, it's like, I don't know how that happened. It's like, Well, we kind of do.
Yeah.
But if it's this touch DNA, you know, it's like, why were you in her apartment? I mean, he could have never been in her apartment.
Right.
You know?
Right. And I mean, he could have been in it months ago. Yes. Yeah. So,
yeah.
And unrelated to any alleged activity. So there's really no way to know when that trace DNA came to be on that object, only that we know who it could have come from.
You know, I don't know if this question, you know, well, the question is, you know, talk about collection, you know, forensics DNA collection at a crime scene, you know, how important it is and where you've seen it go wrong, you know, like, you know, where law enforcement has gone wrong with that, the collection, and then where, you know, obviously where it goes right.
Yeah. So investigator mediated contamination is a real thing. And that means, like, if you're at the crime scene and you're not properly trained to collect that evidence, you run the risk of not only introducing your own DNA into the mix, but you could potentially cross-contaminate evidence while you're doing the collection. So one, if you're not wearing the proper personal protective equipment, so if you're not wearing gloves, if you're not wearing a mask and you're talking over whatever item of evidence you're collecting, you could potentially be transferring your DNA onto that item. The gloves have been shown to be a high vector of DNA transfer. So if they're not properly decontaminated, if you go pick up one object with one pair of gloves, package it up, and then go pick up another object without changing those gloves or wiping them down with some kind of bleach solution, you could potentially be transferring DNA from that first object to that second object without even realizing it. So I've, like, in the course of my consulting, I watch a lot of body cam footage and kind of watch all those different kind of contacts and kind of say, hey, the way you guys were handling this evidence, there is a high risk of that investigator-mediated contamination just because you weren't, changing out your gloves, you weren't decontaminating them, and you were picking up items of evidence like clothing and then picking up a firearm. So there's potential that you could be transferring DNA from that clothing item to the firearm without even realizing it. And then, you know, if they're talking over everything, I mean, I tend to suggest when I'm watching that, I'm like, not only should they, you know, collect evidence from the defendant to do a comparison, but they should collect evidence, or the references from all the officers to kind of see if they've gotten their DNA into the mix, and maybe that'll help answer some of those transfer questions.
And this might speak to what you just spoke to, but you know, if law enforcement and lawmakers came to you and they were like, hey, what can we do to make DNA science better, you know, so we're catching more people, identifying more does, what would you tell them?
I mean, it starts with them in the field, getting their proper training, because the DNA evidence is only going to be as good as what they collect at the scene. So if they're, picking up an item and putting it on a surface to photograph it, you have to consider what surface you're putting it on, because is there DNA on that surface that could be transferred to whatever you're photographing? So there's things that I think that they don't think about when they're at the scene, because they're just in the mindset, I need to collect this evidence, I need to do this, you know, this warrant, I'm looking for this certain thing, and they don't think about all the complications that can arise from how they're touching and what order they're touching things and where they're placing them or how they're packaging them. Because even if you package several items together in the same package, there's a possibility of transfer between those items. And so it really, the law enforcement needs to have a very good training program and have, you know, a very specific, I think, crime scene investigation team that knows what they're doing when they go to those scenes and knows how to properly collect that evidence.
You know, when it comes to Lisk, in our case, you know, there was some DNA that was found kind of like on the four bodies, the three bodies, let's say, that he's alleged to have been a part of the killing. They found two hairs from his wife, Rex's wife, and they found one of his. Can you talk about, I mean, some of it seems obvious, but can you talk about how that happens and then how they extract that? Because obviously the root of that hair is no longer there after years.
Right. And depending on when, how it came to be there, like if you happen to pull a hair, you have a bigger, better chance of having that root as opposed to it just naturally falling out. So if it's just a natural shedding process, you mean we all lose hair, you know, I can look at the drain in my shower after I take a shower and see all the hair I've lost. So it really just depends on the condition of the hair when it was deposited. So if the root isn't there, it's ideal to have that root because you can do that nuclear DNA testing. That's the ideal testing because it's easier to differentiate people, like I said. If the root's not present, they typically go for the shaft of the hair and look for that mitochondrial DNA. So once they get a mitochondrial DNA profile, then they can compare that to the individuals in the case or put it in a database and see if there's anybody that's shares genetic information with that person of interest to see if they can narrow it down to a certain family or family group to be able to hone in on somebody to get an actual profile or standard from that person for comparison.
Yeah, and let's talk about that because they're not able to access everyone's DNA to see who matches up, right? I mean, right. That is, you know, because there are privacy issues. One, would you talk about privacy issues when it comes to DNA and then what access they have to DNA samples?
Well, so like for forensics, nobody has access to like that CODIS database except for the labs, and the FBI has ultimate control over that database. So nobody can go into that database and just put a profile in and search against it and get information out of it. That's all controlled within the government, the RAND laboratories. With the online databases, I know that's one of the issues that they're having right now, is that they do have the privacy policies in place, but I think they're kind of getting circumvented in sometimes because there's loopholes in place where they can kind of take advantage of that and do searches against individuals who have maybe opted out of being part of that database in terms of like doing forensic genetic genealogy searches. So that's one of the problems I'm seeing, at least in the media, is they're not complying with those privacy policies and including individuals who have opted out, which can ultimately lead to problems when you go into court and trying to use that information to justify, you know, doing additional testing or using that information to say somebody's guilty.
When you look at the future of DNA, what is that next big mile marker that you're like, man, that's going to change the game? Or what scares you, you know, when you look forward?
So when I operate, you know, as a forensic DNA analyst, I can go into court and say whose DNA is present. But we get those activity level questions quite a bit, like how did the DNA get there? Could this be a reason for the person's DNA to be there? And there is a push in the community to do those type of activity level assessments where we're offering an opinion and a statistical weight on, you know, if I get these DNA results, what's the probability of getting these DNA results given one activity versus another activity? And the research isn't there. I mean, the research is great. We have a plethora of research, but the problem is that we have this like one study, but then nobody comes back and repeats it to see if the results are reproducible and accurate. And so we need that repeatability. And a lot of the studies deal with like the variables that deal with DNA transfer, but don't actually do any kind of casework specific scenarios where we can go and say, oh, this particular piece of literature focuses on a scenario that's closely resembles what's going on in this case. Can we take the data from this and offer that opinion? There needs to be some kind of proficiency test program where we're testing analysts who kind of give these opinions, if they're giving, you know, using the data correctly and offering their accurate opinions. So there needs to be a lot more in place before that kind of activity level assessment comes into play in casework.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you can't just be throwing that willy-nilly because it, you know, if you're going to make assessments, you've got to be on the same page with
right.
with what you're stating. Yeah, you know?
There needs to be transparency where those numbers are coming from, what literature you're using, what you're relying on. And if you're just going in and going, oh, it's more likely that it's this activity over this activity without giving that information, you could be overstating the weight of the evidence, and that could potentially lead to somebody getting falsely convicted of a crime that they didn't commit. And then you have to deal with all the ramifications that go along with that, because, I mean, the damage is done. That person's probably been in jail for a while. And then you have to, you know, the victim's family has to deal with that all over again. And the defendant has, you know, lost his privileges for all that time. And then you, all the stuff that goes along with that, if you're not careful about what you say.
The real rapist or killer or abuser is out there
right.
continuing to do it. I mean, that's another fallout. Well, thank you so much. This is really helpful, and you did a great job explaining it.
Okay, cool.
And that was my chat with DNA expert Cindy Kale, who did a great job of talking through science that is constantly evolving and getting better, luckily. DNA will clearly play an important part in Ray Tierney's case against Rex Huerman, but it's important to know that there are gray areas around DNA, and hopefully Ray Tierney is preparing himself and his team to deal with any questions around DNA that might otherwise hurt their case. Be on the lookout for new episodes, and if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Mopac Audio production. I am your host, Chris Moss. Our senior producer is Shannon McGarvey. Our executive producers are Jonathan Beal and Jonathan Nowazarden, and music by Blake Maples. The views, speculation, conjecture, and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers, guests, and the hosts. They do not reflect or represent the policy or views held by Mopac Audio LLC or any broadcaster of this podcast. Any and all suspects discussed on this podcast are considered innocent until guilt is established in a court of law, and any allegations, speculation, opinion, or conjecture about any suspect is subject to such presumption of innocence.